Like a lot of writers, I started writing before I could write myself. I remember making my older sister write things down for me before I could read. And I think a lot of writers have that deep history in common. Maybe a lot of people do, and writers are the people who continue to pursue it. I wrote throughout my childhood and then really got into it in college when it became a way to stay interested in a lot of things. I was someone who resisted the specialization of a major to major in this or that when there were many things I wanted to stay interested in, and writing seemed like a way to explore all of those. I came primarily to poetry because it seemed to be a place where you could be most fully in that not knowing, in that openness to sound and image, and the way that one phrase can lead to another, absorbing a lot of different types of ways of speaking and thinking. I primarily published poetry. This book, Diving Makes the Water Deep, is my first sustained attempt into a kind of nonfiction or memoir, but I think you see the traces of a poet's ways of thinking throughout it.
For me, writing really plays a day-to-day role, like as a way to figure out how to live, like day by day, and to have this practice, this thing that you're doing that helps you pay attention to the things you want to be paying attention to and figure out kind of how to understand yourself in the larger world. And so my first novel was thinking about that in relation to the war in Iraq. And I kind of started it a few years into that war. And I was really sort of, I was just shocked by the way that that war like disappeared from the news, and the way that it wasn't something that we were talking about or seemed kind of responsible to as a generation, as a country, and this very small number of people were being relied upon to kind of do that war. So I started kind of paying attention to the news from there in a daily way, and that's where I wrote that novel out of that experience. And this book, Watchfires, which came out this fall, is kind of doing the same thing, looking at the Boston Marathon bombing and looking at kind of this long illness I had in my 20s that was undiagnosed for a long time, some of Zach's experience with cancer, and thinking about how those like private experiences of illness relate to our larger public and political life, and how we talk about and think about the political world, and in particular, the war on terror.
Obviously, with the most recent work, Zach, your book, Diving Makes the Water Deep, and Hillary, yours, which again is called Watchfires, you're obviously both very present in each other's recent work. So can you just kind of talk about the influence your relationship has on your writing?
Sure. I think I benefit from this, especially because Hillary has a long career as an editor. And, you know, there's a myth that writers are people who know exactly how grammar and mechanics work, but actually editors are. And I benefit from having Hillary as a first insightful reader in all cases. More basically, I think it's lucky to be married to a writer while I'm writing about my life, because I know that Hillary understands that how writing works. And I think that when you write about something, it changes it, it turns it around. I think we're both people who I would rather see myself represented in an unflattering, revelatory, interesting way in Hillary's writing than in a way that is merely flattering. I think that doesn't turn from our relationship, but instead tries to invest it with a new kind of thoughtfulness that comes back into our life off the page. I've often been interested in the idea, I said in our wedding vows even, that a relationship can be research into what a relationship is, that a relationship isn't a finished point that you reach and perform, but is an ongoing kind of co-investigation. So writing about our lives and our lives together has been a way to do that. And I think it feels very lucky.
You know, there's a lot of good thinking still to be done about the institution of marriage, or, you know, what it is to kind of be in a life with someone and be sharing your kind of your daily life and then your like your sense of yourself. So I think if to have kind of two people who are trying to offer their thinking on that, and maybe there will be some points of contact or overlap or conversation that's happening in that work. I don't know, maybe that's something to offer, right? Maybe that is the kind of writing that could be meaningful, I hope. I guess the other thing, that I was going to say is just the way that the people in the writing are and are not us, and that's kind of an exciting thing to experience. It's a way to kind of feel bigger than yourself. And in this project in particular, which is thinking a lot about like selves and others, and trying to like work at the boundary in between our many others. And marriage is kind of part of that because it's someone that is your other in an everyday way.
I'm Rachel Otwell. This is Illinois Edition. We're speaking with Hilary Plum and Zach Savage, a married couple. Both writers live in Philadelphia. They'll be reading from their recent memoirs on Thursday night. More info for the free event is at illinoisedition.org. Now we will hear parts of their new works. Here's Hilary reading from the beginning of her book, Watchfires.
Did he speak with an accent? She looked up. Between her and the screen were arrangements of chairs which bodies occupied nervously. No, the interviewee said, he sounded just like you and me. Things we'd talk about would be like which rapper was best. On screen, people use the phrase tight-knit community. Here in the waiting room, unironically, a woman knitted. In the theater, he was unconscious. Is there an eye to the anesthetized body? To the still beating heart or the mechanism halted of peristalsis? My belly was opened 3 times. Through the largest incision, they removed the large intestine. He would say, I had colon cancer. He is 30 years old. 4 days ago and 400 miles away, 2 bombs had detonated. How may we describe it? Her brother had lived for years in that city, and still she could only drive anywhere there if she started at that yuppie hardware store. Like hundreds of thousands, she'd been a student on the city's outskirts. Once a year, it was Marathon Monday, and for days after the cheering, no one on campus could speak. She'd once jumped into the race to help pace a friend and had ducked out just before the finish line. At the finish line, 2 bombs exploded. 13 years passed between these moments, though as the race measured time, they were close, the difference between 9 and 9.5 minutes per mile. There were 2 bombs, first one, then the other. There were 2 brothers, one older, one younger. There were cameras everywhere, and later the brothers would appear on every channel, baseball caps and zip-up jackets, dark nylon backpacks, boy and man walking around a corner or standing facing the race amid the crowd. By the time she learned the brothers' names, the older was dead, a shootout with the police. The boy was, what is the phrase, in the wind? A manhunt, a lockdown. Do not leave your homes, the governor instructed the people of the city. On screen, every few minutes, a police spokesman approached a microphone. The trains had stopped running, the buses, cars. In certain neighborhoods, SWAT teams were checking each room of each residence. Upon hearing the name of one neighborhood, she stepped outside to call a friend. Her friend said, the SWAT team came through at 6 a.m. We ran out of wine at 9. The cancer was caused by a genetic mutation. No, the mutation was linked to a high incidence of cancer, a statistical likelihood. If someone knew precisely how this mutation caused tumors or allowed tumors or fostered, it wasn't she didn't have even a verb. His father had had the mutation, and so, one might assume, did his father and his. To think that when, in the last winter, they'd helped the father into and out of bed, his legs swollen beyond what she could have imagined, his hiccups which jolted exactly the site of the tumor, a continual torment, to think that even then, in the belly of the son, the offspring of the father's tumor was growing, feeding on the nourishment meant for every good cell, every other cell. Is it a coincidence, the word cell? A terrorist cell? The newscasters wondered all morning, the long hours authorities hunted the boy. A sleeper cell? Did they act alone?
That was Hilary Plum reading from Watchfires. And now we'll hear Zach Savage read from his book, Diving Makes the Water Deep.
I'm going to read from toward the beginning of the book. This was a book written on the brink of a diagnosis for one of the instances of cancer that Hilary mentioned in hers. I'll read from the beginning. That when I first had cancer at 30, 3 months after my father died at 60 from the same cancer, I thought of these lines from the poet Larry Levis. Levis writes, "The last thing my father did for me was map a way. He died and so made death possible. If he could do it, I will also someday be so honored." I started thinking of it without that final phrase, "be so honored," preferring to end on "someday. If he could do it, I will also someday." In the rooms of explicit examination this week, I've felt the passage is beautiful but hardly true. The last thing my father did for me was die, and so took care of that. I can focus elsewhere. Much as he knew the name of any tree, so I could simply look. Paper covering the elevated examination bed too thin to write on. A part of my body. You could take it between your fingers. It's a part of my body. Go ahead. I felt differently. My father's father died in his 40s from the same cancer, and my father proved he could live. If my father's answer to his father's death was to live, I used to think, my answer could be to accept dying. Marcus Aurelius says, a life of any length is 100% of a life. I first read Marcus Aurelius as an undergraduate teaching assistant at the University of Washington, 2003. I was, somehow, 20. A course pairing books, Freud, Whitman, Alberti, with slides of paintings, dance stills, stones. The professor presented one day a week. I led discussion the next. In the Aurelius session, I rejected the philosopher emperor's detachment. He says, for instance, that if you find yourself enchanted by a melody, save yourself like this. Consider each note of that enchanting melody in turn and ask if it alone is what enchants you, and thus be spared from harm. But if I am enchanted by the melody, when I consider each note in turn, the answer must be yes already.
Zach, obviously your health status and your family's genetic history with this cancer is woven throughout the most recent work. And one of the most beautiful things about the writing, at least from my perspective, is your play on this notion with the idea of entanglement.
Yeah, I got the phrase from my father, who had a hard last few years. He first had cancer in his 40s, and then, you know, thanks to what treatment can do, ended up living 15 years after that, but with several recurrences, especially toward the end of his life. As he was dying, he often would say, it's not the dying, but the disentangling that hurts or that causes suffering. Not the dying, but the disentangling. Meaning that death itself wasn't what was bothering him as much as the experience of needing to let go, to stop being involved with the complications that are life, that we might seek to avoid if we want a kind of simplicity, but are actually what give things texture and what give us the beautiful kinds of complication and depth that I think we should lean toward. So for me, that's a model that is hard to live up to because life is also difficult. Illness changes what you can do and how you can think and how you think about time. So this book is in some ways an effort to remain interested in the kind of ongoing entanglement of life, even when that life is one marked by treatment and the toxicities of cancer itself and the sadness of needing to cancel appointments and be able to do less than you used to do. I hope that insisting, though, on that kind of involvement, that entanglement, becomes an ethical stance, a way to not turn away. And I love art's ability to bring us closer to the world, to bring us back into the world, even if we might rather avert our eyes.
You also write about dreams you have of the dying or dead, and how while you don't take them to be literal messages from the afterlife, you find them of solace. And I was just wondering if you could talk about your ideas of spirituality and how that might inform your writing.
It's a great question. Illness defies your established beliefs. You might find your brain doing things that it hasn't done before. Sometimes that's obviously an effect of drugs or treatments. Other times it seems to result from the experience, from the extremity of experience, and something happens that I doubt anyone can exactly explain. I found myself trying in illness, trying to allow my brain to go to those places, to not resist ideas or thoughts that might otherwise be outside of what I think. One thing that I found happening to me, both in experiences of grief and while in the throes of my own sickness, were some dreams and other things that felt like premonitions or visitations or amplifications, including some involving my father, who had died not long ago. Most pointedly, I had a dream shortly after his death in which I was visited by him and given a sense of well-being, embrace, possibility, that I think is not uncommon among people in that experience. I'm not sure how this reflects back into my spiritual thinking more generally, except that I'm happy to accept it and think about how the unknown is often present with us.
This is Illinois Edition. That's Zach Savage. He'll be reading at the station on Thursday night. That's here on the UIS campus in the WUIS building. It's part of the Shelter Belt Reading Series. More information at illinoisedition.org. Zach will be joined by his wife and fellow writer, Hillary Plum.
So Hillary, your work, as you mentioned, has this interplay of illness. You talk about your own in the past and your husband's, but then you look at society's illnesses at large, at politics. Terrorism is a big theme in more ways than one. Can you talk about those parallels in the novel and how you came to them?
I think I really came to them just through coincidence. You know, the scene that book starts in that I just read from, of sort of sitting in this waiting room while, you know, my husband was getting a surgery, and, you know, they're kind of, the surgeons are on this kind of hunt through the body for a tumor, and at the same time, kind of playing on CNN all day is this hunt through the city, you know, of Boston for this, for the younger of the two Boston Marathon bombers. And there was such a kind of resonance between those two events, and they were both kind of intense to be in. And so I started writing in that scene, and the book kind of unfolded from there. And I wanted to think about how our political world is structured by metaphors of disease, you know, sort of like diseases of the body, and then of the body politic, and how we think about, you know, how we think about terrorism or other kinds of violence in terms of disease. So that's what the book is really looking at. And maybe, you know, the inverse of that is that I wanted also to think about, you know, what are the politics and the ethics of how to live with disease? You know, how do we think about that sick time, you know, time that you spend where you're, you know, as Zach was just talking about, you're confined and you can't maybe act as you would like to act in the world or have the effect that you'd like to have. So how do you kind of think about yourself as a person in society in those times? And of course, those questions apply to all of one's life. They're just sort of really present when you're ill.
What are your thoughts on what writing can do as a means of protest or examining the political?
I mean, I think that's a hard question and an essential question. And one, I sort of, in the book, at some point I borrow actually from one of Zach's ways of asking that question that has always stayed with me, which is to say, you know, what can literature be a cause of? And I guess, you know, I don't have an answer for, you know, what that might be in the larger world, because I think in some ways the answer has to be built by readers or by individual readers. And even to say, you know, to write a book, you can't really even quite say what the book is, because you're sort of handing it off to people to read and they get to say what it is or not, you know. So I think I can really only think about it in a personal way, which was that for me, the book was a way of kind of making sense of those experiences of illness and of living through the years of the war on terror and the kind of media and the rhetoric around terrorism, and that I wanted to really try to connect, just try to make sense and connect those experiences and see what meaning could be made, and if there was a way to kind of intervene in some of the ways that we talk about terrorism, you know, even in a small way, even just in kind of one book and the people who read that book, that seemed like it still could be something to do.
Great. And so this last question is for both of you. So not to state the obvious, but one thing about literature is that it has the ability to live on longer than its authors do. And both of your works experiment with the genre of memoir, sharing these very insightful and contemplative parts of your psyche. Do you spend much time considering that and aiming to leave a certain kind of legacy?
I guess I haven't really thought about it like that exactly, but I have thought about, you know, writing so much in a particular time, like a historical moment, and one that's already changing. You know, when I go back and look at my first novel, and it feels like it belongs to a certain short moment that's kind of already over or is changing. And I don't think that means the novel is over or that, you know, it's like, but it's different, right? Like it becomes a different kind of text or a document of some kind. And so I feel like I don't know, you know, when people look back on this 10 years and particular, you know, if I'm thinking about the war on terror, what that might be, you know, that'll change. And our perspectives on that will change. And I don't know, you know, how my own like small work might be a part of that. And I guess I do wonder about that without having, you know, without being able to have an answer.
So I'd wonder if all literature and art only ever exists in the present. It's only ever read in the present. So the legacy of a work is also immediate and ever new. Every time that a book is read or a painting is looked at, it exists again. It's almost made again or composed again. It's rewritten by the person reading each word piece by piece. I think in those terms, I hope that my work is, that I wouldn't be ashamed to have some of the deceased people I invoke in it be resurrected again for the space of the book, for the space of what I read. They wouldn't be disappointed. They wouldn't feel like it was a waste of a momentary view back into life on Earth. For those of us lucky to still be on this Earth, the writing similarly gives us a view further in to make the day more like the day or to change what the day is. I think this is also political because, I'm thinking of the poet George Oppen, who wrote, "All this is reportage." And just as the best journalism might reveal aspects of the news and current life that other journalism leaves out, I like literature that shows me other parts of life that are left out of other sorts of media, left out by journalism, which I love, left out by TV, which I love. But there's something that art and literature can access that's different. And I think that there's much in culture that's suspicious of those things, but we know that there's little other history of the moments that seem outside of the official narrative. And those are the moments that make up our life now or into the imagined future.